Welcome, MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. James is not with me currently. He is out starting a Simon and Garfunkel cover band. We are rerunning a podcast that's almost 3 years old today because Mike Nichols died last week. And he made The Graduate, which is a perfect film, one of the most influential American films ever made. And it deserves to be thought about again. Anyway, in true MacGuffin Man fashion, I don't think we mentioned Mike Nichols' name once in this podcast, but I don't know. It's still a great movie, and Mike Nichols directed a perfect movie, and it deserves to be remembered. All right, enjoy.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Will Ferrell. Wherever I am right now, I'm probably shirtless and yelling comically. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me is James.
2K12 edition.
Yeah.
Of James.
Oh, of James, yeah.
I've upgraded.
Okay. New model.
New model.
New and enhanced.
Same parts.
He's got a tablet now.
It's true.
Yeah.
I wasn't even thinking about that.
Okay.
I was just saying nonsense. Anyway.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
We this is not the first one that's running this year. Happy New Year again.
I'm doing this for everyone in 2012.
Okay.
Happy, last year on Earth, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I hope it's good.
We've only got something like 45 podcasts till the end of the world. We'll try and make them count.
Okay. That was a bummer of a start.
Well, it's going to, I mean, this isn't the most uplifting movie we're talking about. So.
Actually, I'll tie it all together here. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So 2012 is all about the end of life.
Yep.
Ever heard of a midlife crisis?
Yes.
Ever heard of a quarter life crisis?
Yes. No, I haven't.
What is a quarter life
crisis? I was getting mixed up with a midlife crisis. Why don't you explain it?
Well, a quarter life crisis is, well, everybody, what's a midlife crisis?
It's sort of like when your dad wants to get an earring at age 44.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Yeah. So, you kind of get about halfway through your life and you kind of think, you know, I'm halfway done my life. Am I happy with what I did for the first half? And what am I going to do with the second half? And you kind of panic a little bit. Well, there's also something called the quarter life crisis, which is becoming more and more common, which is kind of the same idea, but instead of maybe at the age 45 or 50, it's between kind of 20, 25. Mm-hmm. So people finish high school, go off to college, university, you know, graduate, but then don't know what they are going to do. And so a lot of times they move back home, and someone wrote a book about this. I forget her name, but she wrote a book about the quarter life crisis, and our generation is pretty big on it. And a lot of people have moved back home after school and tried to figure out, you know, what to do. And, you know, with a lot of jobs moving overseas or a lot of factors come in that there's not as much work as people were kind of hoping after they graduated. The quarter life crisis is pretty big for our generation.
Mm-hmm.
But even if we're the best at doing it, we're not the only ones who do it. Because the movie we're about to talk about is someone who's kind of having a quarter life crisis, but takes place in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the movie we're talking about is The Graduate.
Yes, it is. Cuckoo ka-choo. I'm excited.
Yeah, so that was 1967. He's already having a quarter life crisis, but it was based on a novel, right?
Yeah, I think by Charles Webb, I think is his name.
And that was 1963.
Yeah.
Yeah, so around the same time.
I can either confirm nor deny.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the whole plot of The Graduate, which I just saw for the first time pretty recently, mm-hmm. is, again, Dustin Hoffman's character, Benjamin Braddock,
mm-hmm.
has finished school. He's finished 4 years of college. He moves back home. Very good student, you know, involved in a lot of clubs and
he's a track star.
Good athlete, good student. Seems to be very well liked socially too, but just not sure what he wants to do. Very, as he says, worried about his future.
Yeah.
He wants to make sure he has a good one, and he's very bright, but he just doesn't seem to know where he wants to go next.
Yeah.
And when did you first see this movie?
I was trying to figure this out actually earlier today. It was either 2005 or 2007.
Okay.
And I have reasons for why I think it was one of those. I would bet on 2007, though. But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. You gave up Dustin Hoffman for the year of 2006, so there's no way it was 2006.
Lent was really long that year.
I just saw it for the first time recently, and this is kind of a cultural staple.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very well-known movie, and I knew all about it, and I knew the basic plot, but I just had never seen it till very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that struck me about this movie is how funny it is.
Yeah. No, I was hoping you would find it funny.
I thought it was just going to be like a coming of age drama.
No.
Dustin Hoffman emos around for an hour and a half.
It's a comedy, man.
It's very funny.
Oh, it's really
especially
funny.
For the first half.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's written by Buck Henry, you know, like.
Who did the screenplay?
Yeah. There's two credited writers, but. The second guy, whose name is Calder Willingham, Buck Henry worked totally independent of him and sort of like turned up a different script. And it was just sort of that since they were both using some lines from the book, Willingham was able to sue and get his name on the credit.
Right,
so the screenplay on film is written almost solely by Buck Henry, I think.
Okay. And what else did Buck Henry do that you say I should know that he's funny?
Well, he plays Liz Lemon's dad on 30 Rock. And he was a staple for SNL hosting when SNL started.
Oh, was he the one who did it like 4 times in a year or something?
Yeah,
something
probably.
Ridiculous.
He like the first 5 years he was one of those like Justin Timberlake type guys that I mean I'm not, you know, different totally different type of person, but it's just like why doesn't that guy just join the cast?
Yeah, you know? He's very funny and everyone seems to think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he also he plays the hotel desk clerk in The Graduate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so very, very funny. And even when I looked it up like on Wikipedia just to see the running time or whatever, they list it as comedy, drama, romance.
Yep. I always see it as a drama in video stores. Well, I mean, when the last time I was in a video store, but it is typically classified as a drama to most people. You know, like most people see it and think of drama just because of how big the movie is, like culturally. And but it's comedy for sure.
Yeah, and it's coming of age. And Dustin Hoffman just kills it at the start, like he's right off the bat.
He's pretty great.
And the other thing that kind of hit me really quickly is how soon they get to most of the iconic stuff about this movie.
Yep. It's really like the first 20 minutes, you get pretty much all of your graduate bases covered with the exception of the church. You know?
Yeah. But I was watching, I'm like, oh, maybe that's going to be the one who hits on him. And then it's like 4 minutes in, she's already trying. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's it.
I love Mrs. Robinson's introduction to this movie where he's sort of like Benjamin's walking into that party and you just sort of see Mrs. Robinson on the chair having a smoke.
Yeah.
And she just sort of perks up a little bit. I love that shot. I don't know why, but I just enjoy it.
Okay.
I think it's good.
If you know that Mrs. Robinson is trying to seduce Benjamin, Dustin Hoffman's character, which you probably do if you've seen it, any of the spoofs that are anything about film that's happened.
If you know one thing about The Graduate, you know that Mrs. Robinson is hitting on him.
Yeah.
You don't know Ben's name, but you know Mrs. Robinson.
Well, exactly. I can't think of another film that sums up the plot so well with its most famous line, you know?
Yeah.
So the rest of the movie is, you know, Benjamin's living at home with his parents after college. His parents really like him, just trying to push him in a certain direction, trying to get him to do something. And he kind of starts up an affair with Mrs. Robinson, which is one of his parents' friends.
Yes.
And kind of spends his summer swimming in the pool by day and getting some cougar action by night.
Yep.
That's kind of it.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for the first half of the movie, that's kind of the plot. It's awesome. It's funny. Their first encounter is very humorous, to the point of just being really uncomfortably weird. And I don't know. And I love Mrs. Robinson in this movie. I think Anne Bancroft is so great.
Yeah, they're both funny. And I mean, neither of them have, I mean, definitely some, but none of them have really, really hilarious lines on paper. It doesn't seem like a very funny script to be reading it, but they both perform it really well and make me laugh a lot. And then, as you said, that's kind of just the first half of the movie. What's the second half?
Oh, by the way, just one thing I want to point out about how much I love Anne Bancroft in this movie. Like, when she's in the hotel lobby when Benjamin's calling her, like, hey, I've got this this room. I've got the apartment, or sorry, the hotel room.
Yeah.
But I think the doorman's kind of onto us, like, do we sneak up, whatever, which is funny in itself. But then, like, when Mrs. Robinson goes to pick up the phone, she, like, puts the phone to her ear and then, like, takes it away and rips this earring, like, this giant earring that was, like, blocking the phone from getting to her. Rips it off, throws it on the table, and just starts talking. And then, like, a couple minutes later, when she's walking into the suite, she pushes the door open, and then it bounces off the wall and hits her again. She looks at the door like, like, what is this door doing? And but just continues on. It's so great.
Yeah. She was married to Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. And then after a while,
the affair going on.
Yeah. And, you know, Benjamin sort of drifting through life still and drifting through the pool. He sort of gets forced into taking out Elaine Robinson, who's Mrs. Robinson's daughter, which he did not want to do.
Yeah, but Hey, I guess his dad said either you take her out for a date or the whole family comes over.
Yep.
So it's the person who's having an affair and the person she's having an affair on and the person's daughter.
Yeah.
Kind of uncomfortable. So he thinks, I'll just take Elaine out and have one really bad date with her, and then we weren't meant to be. That'll be that. Case closed.
And he really tries to, you know, he doesn't, he's not trying to make a second date happen. Like, it's just a really terrible date. He's barely listening to her. He takes her to, I don't know, some titty tassel place.
Like, yeah, I guess it's a strip club.
Is that what a strip club is in the 60s?
It's the saddest strip club. Actually, it's a very happy strip club. But
it was more of a performance art strip club. I think, if anything, it's more cheery. Because it's like, that is a skill.
It is. It's impressive with the one going counterclockwise, one going clockwise. He's, you know, very clearly rude to them and very rude to Elaine during the whole date. And I guess he's never shown himself to be very socially competent. He's very awkward, but on the date, he is rude, not awkward.
Yeah.
He's a mean guy.
And by that time, he is less awkward. It's part of
the
whole thing. But and he just sort of, like, once the, we'll just call her a stripper, I guess, because I don't want to say titty tassler over and over.
I do.
Once the stripper sort of twirls her tassels on top of Elaine's head, that's when Benjamin sort of,
part's funny on paper.
Yeah.
When I said before about some of it not being funny on paper, that's funny on paper.
Benjamin sort of realizes that it's just like, first of all, I don't know why Elaine's still there. But second of all, that's when Benjamin's sort of just like, okay, this is wrong. And then he takes her, gets her outside and, sort of apologizes to her. Then they go to, like a drive-in diner type thing. And, Have a nice little meal, and for some reason Elaine doesn't hate him immediately and leave. And they have a really nice date, and Benjamin realizes he kind of really likes her, and they talk for a bit, and he realizes that, you know, he really wants to be with her.
Yeah, and we don't see Benjamin get along normally with anybody in this movie. His relationship with his parents seems to be not great.
It's one-sided.
His
parents don't really listen to him.
Yeah, they seem to love him, but are kind of maybe hoisting some things on him without listening to him.
Yeah, I think it's he has, I think, a fairly normal relationship with his parents, in that he's saying things, it's just not the things that his parents want to hear. You know?
Yeah, but I just mean, he never really seems to be on the same page with anybody.
Yes.
We don't see him meet any friends.
Yeah, no, we don't see him with any friends.
He doesn't see him with any friends. The party right off the bat, it kind of reminded me of Elliot and E.T., which is kind of weird, but it's, you know, this kid, but then we're kind of seeing it all, like, he's kind of wandering through a very grown-up world, and he spends all these time, even his 21st birthday party, we just seem to see his parents' friends and none of his friends, you know? So for him to get along with Elaine in any way is a really big change from any relationships he's had throughout the movie up to that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, they're at the drive-in there, and the people next to him are being kind of rude and loud, and he puts the convertible top up on his Alfa Romeo, and, you know, they're kind of enclosed in their own little spot, and I thought that was kind of a little sweet moment there of them getting along and kind of making this bubble in the world for themselves that, you know, for the first time he seems to be comfortable and happy, and you can't hear what he's saying, but you can tell for the first time this movie seems to be enjoying himself.
Yeah, and I mean, soon after that, he just says right to Elaine, which is kind of a weird thing to say on first date, look, I really like you and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's clear that he likes her and she seems to enjoy the second half of the date.
Yeah.
And then he sort of pursues her. Things get a little crazy when Elaine finds out that Mrs. Robinson is a woman that Benjamin had been sleeping with.
Yes.
And he does
her
actually
mom.
Yeah, exactly. Benjamin does tell her on their first date that he was sleeping with an older woman, but he never even kind of hints at the fact that it was his mom or her mom.
Yeah, he even says it was an older married woman who had an older woman who had a wife, had a husband and a son. So he really does lie to her in a way, giving her no chance to think it was Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
Okay. And that kind of throws a wrench in the gears, as it would do in real life.
And then basically Elaine goes back to school. Benjamin announces to his parents, I'm Elaine Robinson and I are getting married. He hasn't talked to Elaine about this. Elaine kind of hates him. And that's just sort of goes, that's supposed to show just how obsessed he is with the idea of being with Elaine
yeah.
at that point. And then the rest of the movie is...
Well, I think we should put a pause on it here.
Hmm.
On the subject of Benjamin's parents.
Okay.
I think we'd be remiss. That would be a Feeney call. That
you yeah, Feeney call. Eric Matthews cameoed in this podcast. Mr. Feeney from Boy Meets World plays Benjamin's father.
Boy Meets World, friend of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, let's not act like Will Friedle doesn't have better things to do than come on. And he is a voice actor, so he came by to drop his voice skills. We dropped him 50,000 and, you know.
Yep. But anyway, yeah, I just feel like we needed to mention him. And he really he's did. Pretty funny in this movie.
Yeah. Really did. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, so she goes back to Berkeley. He gets a little obsessed with her, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Follows her to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Starts attending some classes there without enrolling.
Just sitting in
on classes. Yeah. Which they don't mind, apparently.
No. Yeah, that's a funny line.
And he gets a room, just a random boarding room.
Yeah.
With Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not one of those agitators, though, is he? No. He's not one of those outside agitators.
And, yeah, he finally confronts, I guess, Elaine.
Yeah. On he the sort bus. Of watches her from afar for a bit and then tracks her down on the bus and sort of has to, you know, convince her to talk to him again. And
first step towards marriage, I
think. Yeah, and then they sort of... you know, he's sort of following her places, and this is kind of a humorous montage type thing. And they're just sort of talking, and he just keeps asking her, well, will you marry me? And, you know, that type of thing. And he's very obsessed with it. And, yeah, is from there, it's sort of like she leaves to go get married. Is that basically where we are? Like, I mean, yeah, some sort of confrontations happen.
Yeah, and then she disappears mm-hmm. and doesn't tell Benjamin where she's going. And then Benjamin does some detective work.
Yes.
Driving from place to place, you know, assumes a couple different identities over the phone to try to get the location of Elaine, and then he finds out that she's about to marry Carl Smith.
Yeah, the old makeout king.
All that frat stuff was so funny.
It's really funny.
The old makeout king.
Yeah, 60s frats, humorous.
The lamest like thing to be infamous for.
You know, as soon as that scene ended in the bathroom, they started whipping each other with like wet towels or something. Yeah.
Good times. But anyway,
good times in those frats 50 years ago.
Good times with making out. So yeah, he's going to be marrying Carl Smith, she's going to be marrying Carl Smith, which is the guy that Benjamin kind of walked in on the date of at the start.
Yeah. He's a really good walker, zoo. Though, Carl.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that.
Yeah.
And finds out that she's going to be marrying him in a certain, a First Presbyterian Church or something.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
Wow, that's good for me. stops to get some gas, or stops to get some directions at a gas station, but doesn't get gas.
Yep.
The car breaks down about a couple blocks away. He turns on his track star legs.
Yeah, and runs.
Runs to the church. Does he make it in time, though?
Not really.
Not really.
No, but he still ends up getting Elaine away from everybody. And...
yeah, it's if you've seen Wayne's World 2,
yeah.
It's the exact ending from Wayne's World 2, pretty much. She says, I do. They kiss. Benjamin kind of sneaks into the church right at that moment and starts pounding on the glass.
He gets up to like a second level where it's just sort of the small glass room. With these really tall windows, and he's just banging on the glass going, Elaine! I can't even do the voice. It's just...
Dustin Hoffman's voice is so weird.
It is weird. Actually, I was the other night I was watching a cooking show or something on like the Food Network, Chopped is what it was called. And one of like
when did you watch the Food Network?
I was next door to Kimmy and Brian
okay.
and Kristen.
That makes
and,
sense.
Kristen actually pointed out to me that one of the judges sounded exactly like Dustin Hoffman, and he totally did. It was amazing. He looked kind of like skinny Brett Ratner, but sounded like Dustin Hoffman. It was very odd. Anyway, Dustin Hoffman has an odd voice.
But. Wait, I'm going to continue his tangent for one more second. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, I know you don't watch a lot of Family Guy, have you seen the early one where Tom Tucker at the news station says he has an exclusive interview with Dustin Hoffman?
I'm sure I've seen everything before Family Guy got canceled. I've seen all of those.
Okay, yeah, it would be there. And I was trying to find it online to post it.
Yeah.
But it's he claims to have an exclusive interview, and then they just show a clip from The Graduate, and it's him saying, are you trying to seduce me, Mr. Tucker?
I do remember that.
And then he's like, no, I'm not trying to seduce you. And then goes back to Dustin Hoffman and Hook. Bring me Peter Pan. Anyway, I can't find that clip anywhere.
Yeah, so no, I've definitely seen that. Yeah, I remember that.
But it entertains me greatly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
I wouldn't put that past local news.
So he steals Elaine away. He kind of pretty violently too. I thought it was gonna be she sneaks out the window or something.
She slaps Mrs. Robinson. He's like waving people away with a giant cross.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a brawl, and he kind of pushes some people away. Anyway, they break for the door, uses the cross to close the door. Yeah. Classic.
Yeah. To lock it. You know, it's sort of like how you'd see someone use a broomstick between two handles to stop the door. He uses a cross that way, a large cross.
Yeah, and then they hop on a bus.
Yeah, they run to chase down this school bus full of
people.
I
don't think it is.
Okay.
I think it's just the yellow bus. Just yellow? It certainly looks like a school bus from the outside.
It's certainly not school children on the bus.
No, exactly.
It's, I think, pretty much all adults.
Maybe it's adult continuing education center or some kind.
Totally possible. Again, we've pointed out already that we're fairly out of touch with the 60s. Being born in the 80s.
And then this is kind of the closing
scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
They sort of get to the back of the bus. They sit down.
They laugh. They look at the people behind them. Yeah. They laugh. They laugh.
The people on the bus look at them while they're laughing. Like, what's so funny? And they're all just sitting looking at you in your wedding dress.
Yes.
And this sweaty track star next to you dressed in like a suit type thing.
Yeah. And then they stop laughing.
Yeah.
And they don't get sad, but they kind of just get calm. They look a little kind of nervous or confused or something.
Yes.
And then the movie ends.
Yeah. We get it's sort of a longer shot of them sitting. The shot's probably like 30 seconds from them stopping to laugh, 30 to 45 seconds of them stopping laughing and then just sort of being sitting there pretty much emotionless.
Yeah.
Maybe with a tinge of confusion or something.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And then we get sort of one last shot of the back of the bus as the bus drives away. And, that's the end of the movie.
Exactly. I do want to talk about the ending a bit because I think it is a little contentious for some people and maybe interpreted different ways by different people.
Okay.
But we can look at the kind of the rest of the movie for a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, actually, when the credits play, we get some more music.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the soundtrack
Sound
a little
of silence.
Bit?
Yeah. The soundtrack is all Simon and Garfunkel songs. Like, even the song that the people next to them at the drive-in diner are playing, that's a Simon and Garfunkel song. And, you know, Sounds of Silence is used at the beginning and the ending. Scarborough Fair is used, April Comes, She Will. Sounds of Silence is used again in the middle.
Yep.
The
original Mrs. Robinson
song. That's true.
Which is different than the one we all know and love.
Yes, but, you know, it's still...
It's still good. It's just not. Exactly. It's just kind of lyrics and little things are different. But
yeah. I mean, I like Simon and Garfunkel. I feel like it works for the movie. I think. Sorry, your take.
I like Simon and Garfunkel as well.
Okay.
And I didn't listen to a lot of them. Like my parents, I guess they do like them, but we just didn't listen to a lot of them growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of found them out later, and they're good. And I mean, it's all folky 60s fun.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It's enjoyable.
Paul Simon is like Bob Dylan for wimps, as far as I'm concerned. You know, like he doesn't.
He's not the masculine, brawny.
Well,
Bob Dylan.
I think there's more masculinity, like stereotypical masculinity, in Bob Dylan's lyrics than there are in
true.
Paul Simon's.
I'll
and also the voice.
And he's taller than 4 feet.
Yeah. And Art Garfunkel just kind of sounds like a girl.
Yeah. But we love you.
Nobody loves Art Garfunkel. That was a tool. I enjoy the music. I like the way it works. I think it really works with this movie, given that, I don't know, I feel like Simon and Garfunkel music, it's fairly, like, it's aged well. The people that Simon and Garfunkel are often used as a joke, and I understand why, but I mean, I think the only way the music in this movie could be jarring is because Sounds of Silence, particularly, is just such a well-known song culturally. I mean, even probably the least known song in this movie, April Come She Will, was used in a Parks and Rec episode last year.
It about April?
Yes, it was the wedding episode. And I mean,
we get
I like the music a lot.
We get Sounds of Silence in Old School too,
which is a light parody of
directly falling into the pool and all the underwater shots. Even though there never is a moment where in this movie he's underwater listening to that song, but it's clearly supposed to be a graduate thing.
Yeah.
Funny. What do you think about when kind of a band does a whole soundtrack?
I mean, I'm fine with it. I like it if it works. Some, you know, the people I can think of, it's sort of like lone musicians that end up scoring films, like Nick Cave working with Warren Ellis to do like The Road, The Proposition, and Jesse James.
Trent Reznor.
Yeah, and Atticus Ross doing Social Network and now Dragon Tattoo. But, I mean, you don't see bands scoring a lot of, you know, well-known movies. Like, I know...
Tron Legacy.
That's true. Yeah, Daft Punk doing doing Tron Legacy. That's true. And that was very much a film score more than a Daft Punk score. Like, there were a couple moments that were just full-on Daft Punk. But
it was times when they were at a club where you would listen exactly, to Daft Punk
music. Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, for the most part, that score, I mean, it had a lot of orchestral elements as well.
Yeah.
It was a very good score. But, and yeah, I mean, I feel like Broken Social Scene has done a film score, but for like a very small independent film. And I'm not talking about This Film Is Broken, which takes place at Broken Social concert. The Roots, I think, did a soundtrack for a small independent film recently, like a Philadelphia independent film or early 90s. I don't know. Something like that. But yeah, you don't see it a lot.
Yeah. And AC/DC did something.
I think it's just, yeah, I think it's just sort of like AC/DC songs.
Okay.
Because that was the same gimmick with Iron Man 2, which is still confusing to both of us, I'm sure.
Little trivia for you. I don't have a full-on activity for this movie. I'll let you know right now.
That's cool.
So activity will be a trivia question.
Cool. Excited.
Which you may know because you may have read it in research for this, but... The soundtrack for this movie was popular.
Yes.
Because Simon and Garfunkel were very popular in the 60s. And this was kind of really helped make them too. Like they were around before this, but my understanding is this really boosted their profile.
Yeah, and I think if you ask somebody to name two Simon and Garfunkel songs, I think if you do a wide reach, if you ask 100 people, 98 people will give you the two songs, Mrs. Robinson and Sound of Silence.
That's true.
You know, assuming those people know Simon and Garfunkel off the top of their head, you know.
Sounds like a great episode of Folk Family Feud. Another one.
Hosted by Devendra Banhart, I'm sure.
Okay. Anyway, what... This soundtrack became number one. What did it knock out of the number one position? In early 1968. This movie came out December 22nd, 67.
I don't know. I'm really bad with old music dates. Okay. Revolver by the Beatles.
White album.
Oh,
close.
Yeah. I think that means I was probably only off by like a year.
Well, yeah.
The Beatles put out like a record every year, right? Yeah. That was their thing.
Yeah, so I think that's all I got for the music.
Okay, yeah.
Probably more time than we spend on any other music, no, that's so true. We can move on.
Yeah.
One thing that when we talked briefly about this movie earlier, you mentioned the water and kind of the use of water and maybe what it represents. And even just earlier in this podcast, you said the way he's drifting through life, he's kind of drifting through the pool for that part of the summer.
Yeah.
What other kind of meanings do you see from the water in this movie?
Well, I mean, I think the big one, and this is something that is all throughout, or very prominent in the first half particularly, but there's a lot of womb imagery in this movie. None the least, the pool, the aquarium with the sort of like... the guy in the scuba suit in his little aquarium, who we then later see as sort of like a stand-in for Ben when he's in this full-size scuba suit in the pool.
Yeah.
And
that part's cool, though. When he walks in, it's all quiet.
Yeah, no.
This point of view scene.
Stylistically, this movie's amazing.
Okay.
Like, if this movie was made in 1980, it would be impressive stylistically.
Yeah.
You know, like, if it was made in 1990, it probably would be, too. But, like, this exact movie... But for 67, it's just crazy how stylish this movie is. And when he excuses himself from the party early on, he's walks upstairs and looks out the window and looks at the pool.
Yeah.
And then goes back to his aquarium.
Yeah.
And the idea is sort of he doesn't know where this is the first time in his life that he doesn't have structure and he doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. So his idea is, or at least, you know, not something he's fully thinking, I'm going to get back to the womb.
Yeah.
But like what he desires is something simple, something calm. He desire, like something that he doesn't have to do anything. He wants the womb. And that's why at the very beginning, when he's on that moving sidewalk and the Sounds of Silence is playing, he's moving right to left, which is the opposite of the way like we read. It's generally the opposite way of life moving. So he's sort of like moving backwards.
Yeah, particularly but, Western culture, our understanding of moving forward is going from left to right. The way you read things on a page, the way that even kind of the language of film, as you said, things going left to right usually means progress and moving forward. And yeah, it's, again, it's, we're not the first people to notice this, but there's a lot of womb stuff, and it's a lot about kind of, he's hit this point where he doesn't know where to go, and kind of the only thing, again, as you said, it's more probably more subconscious than anything, but kind of this desire to just devolve and go backwards. And
yeah, and he doesn't even want a world of some form of structure. Like, he's done with structure, you know? Yeah. Like, he doesn't want, you know, another school thing coming up in September. Like, he sort of doesn't want to go to grad school get to that point. And he just wants to go so far back that, you know, he's a fetus. And Mrs. Robinson is a stand-in for a womb as well. Like, it's
Mother. Or, exactly.
And that's why it's sort of the... I don't know, that sequence, I would think probably like 30 minutes in, the first time he has sex with Mrs. Robinson, it's like Sounds of Silence, April Come, She Will are playing, it's like this, otherwise there's no audio. It's this really cool sequence where he goes from the bed of the suite back home and he sort of closes this door where his parents are eating dinner, and then he goes and sits by himself, and it's sort of like him sort of becoming a man because he's a virgin, and that's another part of the movie, like... you know, he's sort of like this very boyish type person, and he squeals a lot like a puppy. And, you know, that's sort of like his, I suppose that it's his moment of coming of age, you know, no pun intended. And yeah, it's just sort of him locking his parents out because he found sort of this other womb, I guess. Yeah. And then he's going from the pool to Mrs. Robinson. Yeah. And it's just sort of these two different options.
And that exact same sequence you're talking about, I think, speaks to what you're saying about this desire to just have no structure, because these kind of scenes and moments just all blur together. They might have been days apart or might have been out of order, but you have no idea of, you know, the actual form of what this is.
Like when that sequence first starts, there's a shot of Benjamin's head in close-up with just a black background, and then it's just after he's turned off the lights in the hotel room, and that's when he sort of gets up and closes this door on his parents and then sits back, or, you know, and then comes out of a bathroom.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm confusing it because it's all very vague.
And the order doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on when I'm watching it, like, I've thought, oh, this is the first, like, he closes the door and then they have sex for the first time. Like, he closes his parents out and then they have sex for the first time. Or this has become the norm and then he's closing his parents out. And I mean, I think it makes the most sense that he's doing that first.
Yeah. You know?
But I mean,
but it's kind of just, that's what a summer is, I guess.
Yeah, great sequence in general.
Yeah, yeah. And just to go back to the one thing you said, a little small thing that I noticed I thought was cool, his scuba mask character dude, the one that he has in his aquarium there, do you remember at the start when she throws his keys to him?
Yes.
And says, drive me home, and this is the first time he's going to really try to, she's really going to try to seduce him.
Yeah.
She throws the keys and it lands in the fish tank and it knocks over the scuba guy that's in there. Yeah. And then later on when he comes out at the party, you know, to me, the first time I saw that, it just seems like kind of fish out of water / human in water he's spending so much time in the water. Like, he's just so out of place in the world that he is, or at least he feels out of place in this world. So, I guess we can talk a bit about Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
Kind of touched on her being kind of a stand-in for her mother or a womb. I don't know. I'll start with a question. Is Mrs. Robinson a villain?
No.
No?
No.
Is she a good character?
Oh, I mean, adultery is kind of tricky to call somebody good, but...
Yeah. Do you think the film tries to villainize her at all?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, maybe, but that could also just be sort of the way we watch movies, that we sort of look for it, and that she's very angry for the second half of the film.
Yeah, she's angry. Here's my take on, I don't think she is necessarily a villain. Here's my take on them maybe trying to make her look like one, or how you could read her into her being a villain. Benjamin Braddock does everything he wants by his own will, so, you know, he's complicit in anything, so if she's bad, then he's probably pretty bad too. But they do a lot to kind of, you know, they dress her up in a lot of animal print. They make her very, you know, dominating and assertive. And
she totally is.
Yeah, which doesn't mean you're a bad person. Just, I think that in tandem with what you, as you said, the moral implications of adultery, to have someone really, really know what they want and be really good at getting it, and for that thing to be what society more or less agrees is morally bad.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes her a bad character. All the kind of animal print and all the aggressiveness she has, I think it's kind of, you know, this older woman kind of stealing Benjamin's innocence a little bit.
Okay.
Kind of,
yep.
You know, putting him in this position where he's awkward, nervous, doesn't know what to do, and she's just kind of going to call the shots for him and take away his sexual innocence. And I think that's one way of reading it.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
There's also a much more sympathetic way of, it was a much different time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we end up finding out she got married, not because she wanted to, but because she got pregnant, and yep. That was kind of just the things to do. And again, we have to look at this in the perspective of the late 60s with, you know, women's liberation and a lot of sexual, you know, liberation coming to the forefront. So there's a more sympathetic way to look at it of, you know, without getting too intense on it. Maybe there's this religious or patriarchal structure in place where she wants to have sex with someone who not necessarily her husband. You know, she doesn't want her entire love life or romance to be made up of this one person who she never really cared about, and now it's up to her to get hers, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. What else do you think of her? You mentioned that you really like Anne Bancroft as her.
Yeah, no.
What
about I think she's the great.
Character of Mrs. Robinson?
I see all the points you've made. I think she really... Benjamin learns something through his time with her. I think she's an extremely important... I mean, obviously, she's an extremely important character in his life.
Yeah.
But also in propelling his life forward.
Yeah.
I think she's totally a key because, I mean, if he doesn't find her, who knows what he does, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he might just end up doing nothing ever, you know? And I don't know.
Yeah, and that's part of the more sympathetic view of her is that maybe she is the one who lets Benjamin see that you can get what you want and you can make up your own decisions and you can move forward in life by getting what it is you want, no matter if your husband or your wife or your parents or whatever doesn't think that this is necessarily what you should do.
Yeah.
Well, how about the juxtaposition between her and Elaine and all the differences we see, you know, visually from the film side of things and just their characteristics and their personalities?
Well, Elaine is, even just only from, you know, looking at the two, Mrs. Robinson looks like she's, she looks older,
yeah.
Even though she's not that much older, the actresses.
I thought that was funny too.
I was so surprised to learn that Catherine Ross was 27 when they made The Graduate. She plays a 19-year-old and looks 19.
Yeah.
That's a big, whereas Anne Bancroft was 36 or something.
Yeah.
But, the big difference to me is that Anne Bancroft looks like an adult and she looks, old. She looks not old, but, she looks like she spent a lot of time living, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Elaine looks very fresh and, new. And I mean, Elaine is a much more submissive person than, than Mrs. Robinson. She sort of just goes along with things.
Strong women don't get titty tasseled on the head and just sit there and take it.
Yes, I agree.
You know the old adage?
Oh, yeah. Who said that? Was it Aristotle?
I think it's in the Bible, but okay. It could be Aristotle.
Right. Yeah, could go that far back. Yeah, and she's a very submissive person, like, all throughout the date, and, I mean, she doesn't leave after that, and she doesn't really have a lot of say throughout the movie in anything.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, so,
and when we get to the marriage thing, when she kind of somewhat agrees to marry Benjamin, it also comes to light that she's somewhat agreed to marry the make-out king. it doesn't really kind of have that much of a say in it. You know, we see Elaine outside and well-lit a lot, whereas we see Ms. Robinson kind of in the dark.
Yep.
Smoking, a very adult kind of thing to do. A lot of things like that. You really do see the kind of old, you know, the two sides. It's like the old, aggressive, lived-in kind of person versus the young, indecisive, kind of go with it.
Yeah, and going back to your point about Mrs. Robinson and a lot of, you know, animal print and stuff like that, Elaine wears very innocent clothing. She wears a lot of sort of like whites and pinks. And,
yeah.
I mean, she never wears anything particularly out of the box or anything like that.
we've already sort of touched on some of the visual stuff about this, but yeah. You really love it stylistically?
Yes. I'm sure I've mentioned this in a podcast, but I love the like late 60s, early 70s sound. That's just sort of my favorite era of sound in film. Just, I don't know. It's not clean yet, but it's good enough. Like it.
Yeah. And you can continue in a second, but the one thing that strikes me when I watch movies from this era is, you'll have someone maybe like in this movie, for example, someone sitting in bed and maybe moving around a little bit and you kind of hear the ruffling of sheets and maybe some background noise, but then complete silence, like absolute nothing on the soundtrack. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe the sound quality is different or if that's a choice that they make to do differently anymore, but that always strikes me.
Yeah. And, you sort of want a more consistent sound now. Yeah. Like, it's what people go for.
Exactly.
And sort of like audio peaks happen in older movies. Like when, Ben's mom screams.
Yeah.
She like that audio is just peaking and it just sounds so rough. And
when Elaine screams in the boarding house.
That's true. But anyways, I like the sound, and visually it's really cool. There's a lot of good long takes in this movie. Particularly when Benjamin's like sitting, not particularly, this is one of like 1,000, but when Benjamin's sitting with Mr. Robinson, like when he's run back down the stairs very early on in the movie and they're sitting having a drink, and then Mrs. Robinson comes down the stairs and she's walking and the camera sort of moves and follows Dustin Hoffman as he gets up, and then it's like, no, sit back down, and then gets back down, and then him and Mr. Robinson go up, and this is all in one take, walk down that same hallway and the camera moves towards Mrs. Robinson. The way the camera takes him through the party at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, it's awesome.
Yeah, and long takes and a lot of just still shots, too,
where
the camera doesn't even move and just has a very, very long take. And
that's everything about that sequence, this sequence where he first has sex with Mrs. Robinson or not, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you're feeling. Everything about that sequence is incredible. I love it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is part of not having the camera move a lot in old movies, but it just definitely gives you a showcase for performances and for the dialogue and stuff and the script. I mean, when there's just nothing else to focus on, it's really all about those two and the words that they have to say. Yeah. Two other things. Well, one other thing that I didn't think you'd like about this movie, because you rail against most of the time, is some of the zooms. That's just something you take with the time period.
The time period, it's fine.
Yeah. Doing it now is unacceptable.
Exactly. And the only reason I'm fine with Wes Anderson doing it is because, I mean, I would bet The Graduate is his favorite American movie of all time. You know, like, that's why you get underwater shots in all of his movies, and all the zooms and stuff you see in The Graduate or in Wes Anderson movies.
Okay. Yeah. And one other visual thing that I saw talked about a lot when I was looking at this is that one, you might be able to describe it better as our visual expert, but the one where it kind of looks like he's running in place.
Yep.
Near the end.
Yep.
The depth of field is so short or something? Or?
I always feel like I'm butchering terms, but they used like a really long telephoto lens for that. And it just sort of, it basically, you can shoot a long distance, but it looks very compressed.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, the idea is to look like he's kind of running nowhere. Yeah. Like he's trying very hard, but getting nowhere.
Right on.
Okay.
Let's get to the ending then.
Okay.
Unless you have anything else to talk about.
Yeah. You seem to like the first half of this movie better.
Yes, because it's much better.
Yeah.
The second half, in my opinion.
It is, I agree, much more entertaining, much more interesting. The idea in the second half is that, and we see this when it really starts in the scene when Benjamin's like, well, can we have a conversation first with Mrs. Robinson? And it sort of shows that, you know, he wanted to go backwards in life up until this point. But at this point, he sort of wants to move forward. This is where he wants a more adult relationship. He wants to have a conversation. He doesn't want to just get in the hotel room and have sex. And, you know, that scene leads to various things. And then soon after, there's the date with Elaine. And he sort of finds that he can have that conversation with Elaine, and that's sort of why he falls for her. And the second half of the movie is all about, and since he sees this, he's like, okay, this is adulthood. Elaine is adulthood. This is what will get me there. And the second half of the movie is basically, the reason it gets boring, I think, is because it's all about sort of furthering his obsession. And the idea is just so we know just how intent he is on, I hate saying obtaining about a person, but I mean, we've said that Elaine is a very submissive person, but in obtaining Elaine, you know, like that's what he wants. And that's what the second half of the movie is about. And like, it's all just further driving that home. And it's only when he gets to like that running shot where it starts to have, the movie starts to have meaning again, like other than he's just so obsessed and it's just like he wants this thing so badly and he's running so hard for it, but he's really going nowhere. And then he gets to the church, there's that church sequence, and then they run away the bus, they're sitting on the bus, and yeah, and that's when they sort of realize that they're laughing together, like, how have we accomplished this? And then it's just sort of the looks on their face, it's just, now what? And it's like, we got this thing that, or at least for Benjamin, and again, Elaine, unfortunate character, but as far as never really getting to make decisions, but they both sort of realize, and I mean, she even looks to him, which kind of drives that home, but it's just sort of like, well, we thought this is what we wanted. Okay, we've got this. Now what?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the ending of the movie, and I love it.
Yeah, so it's, you like the ending, but you feel that they won't be happy.
I don't think that I used to think that. I watched this movie like 3 times in the last few days, and I don't think that necessarily anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and so when they're leaving the church, and after she's, I guess, married, but decides to leave with,
yeah, there are problems with that. I mean,
no. Then that's not what I'm going to point out. I think we're on the same page for that. But Mrs. Robinson says to Elaine, it's too late. And Elaine says, not for me.
Not for me.
And that's just, is she just rejecting, her mother's choices of marrying someone she doesn't love because it's the right thing to do?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that is sort of autonomy on Elaine's part.
Yeah, that seems to be the only time she ever makes a decision, but it kind of just seems like she's doing the last thing someone tells her to do.
Yeah,
like
I know.
The makeout king told her to marry her, so yeah, she marries
her. She's, I mean, she doesn't do that if Benjamin doesn't show up, you know, like she never says that. So.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I'm just trying to give a length of credit.
Okay, I know you've read The Rebel Cell.
Yes.
And their dissection of American Beauty.
Yeah.
And how it's, he says it's a kind of a trope and that there's a lot of movies that do this, but it's a movie that kind of pretends to be about getting free, but is, and, you know, making your own decisions, but it's more about reverting to adolescence.
Yeah.
Do you see this kind of in the same vein?
No.
Okay. And why not then?
And I mean, I haven't read The Rebel Cell in like 5-6 years, so I mean, as it pertains to the movie, like what you just said, I think it sort of shows somebody, it initially shows somebody that wants to revert, like wants to go backwards. We talked about that.
Benjamin, but yeah. Not Elaine.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie really doesn't focus much on Elaine. Again, she's more of an object than a person.
Yeah.
And again, I apologize to our female listeners. Yeah, he wants to revert, but he does end up, you know, about halfway through the movie, he ends up wanting to be an adult. He realizes that he sort of wants to move forward. My take on the end of the movie is, like, he's got his Elaine, he's got the thing that he wants, and he just really hopes he's right. And okay. It's sort of this, about that being what he wants with his life. And, you know, it sort of speaks to this whole, this doubt, like, if you're sort of embarking on something totally new, I mean, always, once you're smart enough to doubt things, you're going to be like, okay, I hope this is the right decision I'm making. And I mean, you really won't know until time passes. And I like that about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's sort of my take. I don't think it's about reversion. I think it's about moving forward.
Okay.
And I think it's about the confusion of moving forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
See, I don't know. I see it as the reversion thing a little bit more. I think he kind of just has it in his head that, there's all this pressure for him to grow up. When are you going to make a decision? When are you going to decide where your life wants to go? I think that Elaine comes along. We don't see that much of their relationship being great.
No, not at all.
Yeah, we see that they're able to talk to each other, but
it's really just that one date.
Exactly. Yeah. It, there could be more, but what we see is just...
It's implied that they're... Oh, is it the second date when Mrs. Robinson sort of beats Elaine to the car? And
yeah,
because
that's the very next day after their first date.
Yeah.
I think he, you know, we don't see much of this going that well. I think he sees this one date and really latches onto it and says, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. This is my direction.
Yep.
And it's not so much about what the actual goal is. It's about having a goal for the first time in a long time. And it's a goal that he's chosen for himself. And I think that's, you know, organic and useful for him. It wasn't Mr. Feeney saying, marry this woman, even though he's all for it. I think he makes a decision that, you know, this is the person I want. That's going to be my goal. I'm going to get it. And gets more focused on having a goal and, you know, obtaining it, as we've said. Mm-hmm. Again, sorry, ladies. and, you know, when he gets it, and I think it's summed up very well in the end. I think it is a complete reversion. I think that when they're on the back of the bus and they stop laughing, they realize, like, okay, we've done this. We've achieved this goal, and now we have, whatever, 60 years together, mm-hmm. and we don't know if they're going to be any good. And to me, again, probably reading too much into things, but...
You can never.
It seems like they're the cool kids at the back of the bus, the back of the school bus. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the grade eights who think they have things all figured out, and they really don't.
Well, they are that momentarily, but the difference is that they figure out that they don't.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think that, I don't know, I think his whole pursuit of her is very short-sighted, and it's more about having a goal than what the actual goal is.
I agree with that. Okay. I'm just sort of taking it from the idea that, I mean, there's always the chance it could work out.
Yeah,
that's true. I think them being worried is totally okay.
Yeah, no. I just think they have a lot to be worried about.
I think,
and it's a small chance it works out with what they've established.
That they are worried shows that that they are yeah. adults. Yeah.
All right. One thing that also blew me away about this movie is, adjusted for inflation, it's like the 20th highest grossing movie in North America.
Really? Ever. That's wicked.
That's great, but yeah. That seems insane for a little comedy drama.
Oh, it was a huge movie that year.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, no, I never would have guessed that high. I knew it was a hit, and I mean, it has to be a hit to be that type of cultural thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, that's awesome.
It just didn't seem like a blockbuster for me.
Well, I mean, anybody, pretty much anybody that you talk to that's like our parents' age has seen this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. A depressingly small percentage of people our age has seen it.
Yeah.
In that it's not 100%.
I know. I told my mom I was watching it, and she was like, I've seen that, but I'd watch it again if you lend me the DVD.
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff.
Your mom knows what's up.
Any other closing remarks about The Graduate or Elaine as an object?
I mean, I mentioned early in the podcast that I saw The Graduate. First time I saw it, I didn't love it. And I think a big part of it was because I hadn't graduated yet.
That helps.
Yeah. I mean, I know people that saw the movie before they graduated from university and still love it. I think Lee McWiggin saw it long before. Like, he seems like someone that's
a big Dustin Hoffman fan.
Yeah, exactly. And The Graduate has to have a big part of that. Yeah. But yeah, and it's not like anybody under the age of 19 will just hate this movie automatically.
What? He used to say Dustin Hoffman is the sun that the entire solar system revolves around. But
I'm okay with that.
That's a tangent.
It's weird. I don't think that anybody necessarily under the age of 20 shouldn't watch this movie because they wouldn't get it. But I think once you turn 20, it's just such a good movie. And yeah. Like once you've sort of experienced like the, where do I go from here? And I mean, I didn't graduate from university probably until I was like 22 or something. But, and it's sort of that, where do we go from here? Is so universal. And it's sort of amazing that The Graduate has stayed as fresh as it is. And, I mean, we've talked about remakes and adaptations, how we're totally fine with them generally. Yeah. This is one of the few movies I would just be upset. I would read online The Graduate being remade. I would get upset, shut down my computer, and go and cry. You know, like, it's such a perfect movie as it is, and I just can't imagine anybody doing anything better than The Graduate, or like than this version of The Graduate. And the idea behind a good remake is to do something kind of different, like focus on something that, you know, the movie didn't focus on, and unless it's sort of like the Elaine story, you know, like that's the only thing this movie doesn't touch on that's interesting.
Yeah.
And, well, I don't even know that Elaine's interesting just because I don't give her anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that feeling of, at least for our generation after university, is sort of semi-universal. I mean, we're, you know, mid to upper class people, you know, we've got Benjamin problems.
I'm the upper class one.
Okay. And I don't know. I mean, I never felt like Benjamin as I graduated, because I had a job like before I graduated, like I had a full-time job. But I totally understand that feeling, like the, where you go, like, I don't know. And it's the first time in your life that you don't have structure theoretically. Like every September you're going back to school. And this September I don't know. You know, it's you know, September comes she will or whatever. And, yeah, but eventually you're going to want something more. And that, again, that's Elaine. That's it's she's the idea of a new life. And we're all just sort of drifting until we find our Elaine. And once we find our Elaine, we still really don't know that that's for sure. Like, it could be a career. Like, you're starting a new job.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is this where the rest of my life goes?
Yeah.
It might not be.
Career, a girl, a place. Yeah. Could be a lot of things.
Exactly. And yeah, we're all just sort of drifting until then. And even then, we're still drifting just sort of with more of a purpose. Just
on a bus instead of a pool.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. We talked about The Graduate. I don't know what we're talking about next week. But I'm sure it will be interesting and you should come back. So thank you again.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Will Ferrell. Wherever I am right now, I'm probably shirtless and yelling comically. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.